Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's October the 24th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, to be completely accurate, I'm beginning to record this first segment of the program here on the night of Monday, October the 21st. And all day I've had something building, which looks like it may be some kind of flu-type bug. And it is accompanied by something I rarely get during my occasional bouts of lung-related crud, and that is the beginnings of a proper sore throat. Now, that doesn't happen to me much. Coughing bouts, yes, but this time it's what may be the early stages of a raw throat. Now, this being the case, I hope you guys out there will excuse me if this first segment is mostly other people. I will see how this turns out tomorrow, and if I'm able to do any ranting and raving at you then. Remember my informal series of pieces I do on occasion about the history of our movement? Names that you people need to remember and things that you need to know so that you'll know that we do, in fact, have a long history, much older and deeper than Screwdriver? Well, we have a comrade who is just a past master at locating old audio clips from our past, like this one from the late Dr. Revelo P. Oliver.
We can blind children, but we cannot give them sight. We can stunt and debauch their minds in progressive schools, but we cannot give them intelligence they did not inherit at birth. It is likely that we can make criminals of them by putting them, like the somewhat improbable Oliver Twist, in Fagin's gang or its equivalent, but we cannot induce a moral sense in one who was born without it. We have always known that it is easy for man to destroy what he can never create. All men are created unequal, and there is nothing we can do about that.
He appears to have found a copy of Dr. Oliver reading his immortal essay, Conspiracy or Degeneracy, which I haven't been able to listen to yet, but which I will most certainly be sharing with this audience. But right now, I want to play for you a rather eerie bit of audio from the late Charles Lindbergh. You know, Lucky Lindy? The first man ever to fly the Atlantic solo? Do they ever even teach that anymore in public schools? Well, any of you ever see the movie with Jimmy Stewart? Come to think of it, how many of you even know who Jimmy Stewart is? Anyway, in addition to flying the Atlantic and getting his baby son kidnapped and murdered by a Jew named Isidore Fish, Charles Lindbergh was the head of the America First Committee and the leading public figure trying to keep America out of the insanity of World War II. You know, regardless of the propaganda since then, not all Americans at the time were all that hot and bothered about Hitler. Now, this speech I call eerie because it was made in Des Moines, Iowa on September the 11th, 1941, 60 years to the day before the 9/11 attack. So if you're of a mystical turn of mind, you might make something out of that.
We cannot allow the natural passions and prejudices of other peoples to lead our country to destruction. The Roosevelt administration is the third powerful group which has been carrying this country toward war. Its members have used the... Its members have used the war emergency. Its members have used the war emergency to obtain a third presidential term for the first time in American history. They have used the war to add unlimited billions to a debt which was already the highest we have ever known. And they have used the war to justify the restriction of congressional power and the assumption of dictatorial procedures on the part of the president and his appointees. The power of the Roosevelt administration depends upon the maintenance of a wartime emergency. The prestige of the Roosevelt administration depends upon the success of Great Britain, to whom the president attached his political future at a time when most people thought that England and France could easily win the war. The danger of the Roosevelt administration lies in its subterfuge. While its members have promised us peace, they have led us to war, heedless of the platform upon which they were elected. In selecting these three groups as the major agitators for war, I have included only those whose support is essential to the war party. If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement. I do not believe that any two of them are powerful enough to carry this country to war without the support of the third. And to these three, as I have said, all other groups are of secondary importance. When hostilities commenced in Europe in 1939, it was realized by these groups that the American people had no intention of entering the war. They knew it would be worse than useless to ask us for a declaration of war at that time. But they believed that this country could be enticed into the war in very much the same way that it was enticed into the last one. They planned, first, to prepare the United States for foreign war under the guise of American defense. Second, to involve us in the war step by step without our realization. Third, to create a series of incidents which would force us into the actual conflict. These plans were, of course, to be covered and assisted by the full power of their propaganda. Our theaters soon became filled with plays portraying the glory of war. Newsreels lost all semblance of objectivity. Newspapers and magazines began to lose advertising if they carried anti-war articles. A smear campaign was instituted against individuals who opposed intervention. The terms fifth columnist, traitor, Nazi, anti-Semitic were thrown ceaselessly at anyone who dared to suggest that it was not to the best interests of the United States to enter war. Men lost their jobs if they were frankly anti-war. Many others dared no longer speak. Before long, lecture halls that were open to advocates of war were closed to speakers who opposed it. A fear campaign was inaugurated. We were told that aviation, which has held the British fleet off the continent of Europe, made America more vulnerable than ever before to invasion. Propaganda was in full swing. There was no difficulty in obtaining billions of dollars for arms under the guise of defending America. Our people stood united on a program for defense. Congress passed appropriation after appropriation for guns and planes and battleships with the approval of the overwhelming majority of our citizens. That a large portion of these appropriations was to be used to build arms for Europe, we did not learn until later. That was another step. To use a specific example, in 1939, we were told that we should increase our Air Corps to a total of 5,000 planes. Congress passed the necessary legislation. A few months later, the administration told us that the United States should have at least 50,000 planes for our national safety. But almost as fast as fighting planes were turned out from our factories, they were sent abroad, although our own Air Corps was in the utmost need of new equipment. So that today, 2 years after the start of war, the American Army has only a few hundred thoroughly modern bombers and fighters, less in fact than Germany is able to produce in a single month. Ever since its inception, our arms program has been laid out for the purpose of carrying on the war in Europe far more than for the purpose of building an adequate defense for America. Only one thing holds this country from war today. That is the rising opposition of the American people. Our system of democracy. Our system of democracy and representative government is on test today as it has never been before. We are on the verge of a war in which the only victor would be chaos and prostration. We are on the verge of war for which we are still unprepared and for which no one has offered a feasible plan of victory. A war which cannot be won without sending our soldiers across an ocean to fight and to force a landing on a hostile coast against armies stronger than our own. We are on the verge of war, but it is not yet too late to stay out. It is not yet too late to show that no amount of money or propaganda or patronage can force a free and independent people into war against its will.
And to wind up this segment, here's part two of the speech made by J.B. Stoner to a National States Rights Party meeting sometime in the 1990s. I know that last week I said the 1980s, but in this segment he refers to Clinton being president. Like I said last week, J.B. was one of those fixtures in the movement that back in the day we always just kind of took for granted. He was always around. He would drive 1,000 miles to attend a demonstration, anybody's demonstration, or to speak to a small group of people in a rented motel banquet room anytime, anywhere, wherever he was needed. And for many years, no racial meeting or Klan rally anywhere in the South was complete without him.
And be a slave majority. And that's what we are today in the United States. The Jews and the other forces they use, like the niggers, the communists and all, they have reduced us white people to the equivalent of slavery. And give them a little more time to export the rest of our jobs and factories and agriculture, and we will be very poor slaves. It will be like living in Bangladesh or Haiti. Of course, the Jews say they don't hate anybody. They're the children of the father of lies, so they're good at lying. Jesus Christ says that the Jews are the children of the father of lies. He says that in the Gospel according to St. John, chapter 8, verses 44 to 48, that they are the children of the father of lies, and they sure are liars. They know how to use lies to manipulate most people. We lost the school integration fight in the South because only a handful of us put up any resistance. Then along came busing. Well, I could see that if the white people were not willing to put up a fight to stop race mixing in the schools and to keep the niggers out of the schools, they weren't going to put up much of a fight to stop busing. Then the John Birch Society comes on the scene. And I would say if it hadn't been for the John Birch Society and the National Indignation Convention in the state of Texas, that the state of Texas would have put up more opposition to school integration than any other state in the South. But they said, well, you got to fight communism. The National Indignation Convention, which got to be a big outfit in Texas back in the 60s, they said, we've got to stop the government from selling airplanes to communist Yugoslavia. That was a one-issue organization. Well, the airplanes had already been sold to Yugoslavia. They didn't need to sell Yugoslavia, communist government over there anymore, airplanes. But yet, that was the whole purpose. And so they got a lot of people interested in that, and they wouldn't allow anybody to, any of their meetings, to get up and say anything against school race mixing. Then you had the John Birch Society to come into Texas, like all over the country, and they said, well, that's racism. If you oppose these niggers in school integration, you're a communist. How insane can they be? And how insane can anybody be to believe that Jew government lie? The John Birch Society did that on school integration, and they did it on busing. They told white people who were protesting busing when it would start, you can win if you just leave race out of it. And, of course, most people want to go the easy way. They don't want to fight. They don't want a confrontation. So the busing fight was lost. Then, I don't know how long they've been around exactly, but back during the busing episode in public schools, the Justice Department had a community relations service. These people holding anti-busing rallies would let these federal agents from the Justice Department, from the Justice Department's community relations service, come into their meetings and get up and speak on their platforms. Bunch of cowards, it's best to let them do that. Traitors at work. The community relations service had the objective of telling people in anti-busing groups, you want to avoid confrontation. You don't want to get in an open fight with niggers. You don't want to have a crowd of whites out here with a mob of niggers, posing a mob of niggers over school buses. You've got to avoid that and avoid the race issue, and you'll get somewhere. Well, you get into a nigger school jungle that way. And the community relations service of the Justice Department is still operating. They say, do not have racial confrontation, and I'm telling you, one of the best ways to stop race mixing and the aggression of the race mixers is to have that confrontation. Since the other side, our enemies, are afraid of it, well, that's a good recommendation for confrontation. I know that when you have confrontation, you have the television cameras there, you have the newsmen, and you get to put your message on radio and television all over the United States. When you have no confrontation, when we're against something evil, why not say we're against it? Why say nothing? The other side squeaks and squawks and everything else, and yet they get what they want. Of course, they have the Jew-controlled media behind them. They have the professors and the teachers, and nowadays they have big business. Not only the Jew money power supports the race-mixing program against us white people, but they control big business enough, and what they don't own, they dominate. So when it comes to your big corporations, most of them are making war against us white people just as much as any communist in the country. They're the ones that ship our factories and jobs and agriculture overseas. Now, somebody might say, well, how are they going to ship our agriculture overseas or to some other country? It's very simple. Under this NAFTA treaty with Mexico, they're letting them send in tomatoes and oranges and other things like that. The tomato people in Florida were promised by Clinton, that lying scumbag, and his Jew. The same way with the Organization of American States, of which I guess every country in the northern and southern hemisphere here in America is a member of it. They signed away our national independence whenever they put that treaty through. Also in regards to the CETO treaty for Southeast Asia. On paper, they've already taken our national independence away from us. But they still weren't able to put world government into effect. But when Ronald Reagan came along, a former member of United World Federalists, and the man who got Senator Dole in the U.S. Senate to ratify the Jew Genocide Treaty, they took the attitude, well, instead of having these multi-nation agreements to abolish their freedom, well, that hasn't worked as well as we wanted. So there is a better way to bring about a world government. They're doing it right now, and they've been doing it under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, more so than previous administrations, and the previous ones are all no good. I don't know of one single, since I've been 8 years old, I don't know of one single president that we've had who was a loyal, patriotic American and who put white Christian America first. I don't know of a single one. Of course, you have this two-party setup that the Jews control. They control the news media. So they're able to make it so they don't care which candidate gets the nomination of the Democratic or Republican Party or which one wins. As long as they know that everyone running is seeking to get the support of the Jews and will carry on the Jew program, whatever it might be, why, they're satisfied. It doesn't make any difference whether they have a Bush or a Clinton. The Jews are still in power. So that's what they did. They decided the best way to bring about world government was to have so-called free trade, which has never been freed. The Jews have controlled international trade for centuries. They even controlled it back at the time of the Roman Empire, within the Roman Empire. They control international trade today. It is not free trade. Free trade, so-called free trade, is treason to the United States. So they decided to bring on all this free trade. So if you go to a store to buy a product, it might be made in Red China, or it might be made down in Dominican Republic, or one of these backward third world countries. They say, well, if we had tariffs on all of that, it would lower our standard of living. Well, I say, whenever they ship our best paying jobs, factory jobs and agricultural jobs to other countries, and there's nobody left with enough money to buy anything, that is not getting us a higher standard of living. They're traitors. Now they're trying to bring about world government through getting rid of all of our factories and agriculture.
You know, there's a whole new genre of racial, folk, and rock music starting to emerge from the cultural underground. I've played some of these songs on here by people like Arland Brand in England and Lawrence Adams in Kentucky in that BNP group last week. Now, this week, we're going to hear from a guy named Eben Brooks out in California. He's a kind of major minstrel for the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, and he also sings a lot about Cthulhu and Lovecraft-related themes. I haven't heard any of those songs yet. I'll have to dig some up. But the comrade who sent me this did so with a nudge-nudge and wink-wink. If you listen to this song, it has a very subversive ring to it. And while I couldn't find anything on Brooks's website that was overtly racial, the Lovecraft thing is a dead giveaway. I'm told on the QT that, yes, if you were to put an insurrectionary meaning on this song, you wouldn't be wrong, put it that way.
This is called The Man Dressed in Brown.
Brand new. First audience to hear it.
What brings you out so far, said the man dressed in brown. I've come for one of yours, said the king's faithful hound. And I'm bound where you're bound, and I'll run you to the ground. I've come for one of yours, said the king's faithful hound. Surrender her to me, said the king's faithful hound. Not while there's breath in me, said the man dressed in brown. For we're bound where we're bound, though the dangers be profound. Not while there's breath in me, said the man dressed in brown. How will ye fight on land, said the king's faithful hound. With a pistol in my hand, said the man dressed in brown. And the sound will resound, just as when we stood our ground. With a pistol in my hand, said the man dressed in brown. How will ye fight in the black, said the king's faithful hound. With a good crew at my back, said the man dressed in brown. And what we found will rebound on the conscience of the crown. With a good crew at my back, said the man dressed in brown. Methinks I hear a wave, said the king's faithful hound. It's a signal from your grave, said the man dressed in brown. And the hound then stood down, with a sigh he turned around. There's nothing left to save, said the king's former hound.
Recently, Harold sent me three books, and the one I'm going to talk about tonight is The Rising by McGary. This is really a story about how in the 1900s, the Fenian tradition was really kind of dying out. It was seen as quaint. And what happened in The Rising is you had a few unrepresentative individuals who really had an impact. The Irish paramilitary groups, and ever since The Rising, all the groups in Ireland, the paramilitary groups, have really trusted themselves to this event. So how did they do it? Well, they had this sort of a Sinn Féin group, and what they would do is they would get involved in these various organizations. Well, initially, actually, you had the United Irishmen, and then you also had a group called the Defenders, and the Defenders would become more prominent, really, when you start talking about the IRB and the IRA. What you really see is a very conservative Catholic sort of revolution going on, and that's why I think it's hard to call it really leftist. But they wanted to promote Irish culture as distinctive. Irish separatism was really marginal and it was divided. You had the Irish Parliamentary Party, and they were really very moderate. You had something called the Land League, and these groups tended to be infiltrated by the British security forces. But by 1900, Fenianism was not seen as a threat. Groups like the IRB, they would have pilgrimages to Wolfe Tone's grave, and Wolfe Tone had been a very important figure with the United Irishmen. They used cultural events like that to create cohesiveness and to give people a sense of a spiritual identity. Now, one of the key things they did was they set up a group that did a lot of scouting, primarily with Irish boys, so that they would be taught a kind of self-sufficiency and a kind of military preparation. You had certain families that were really into this in various parts of Ireland, and eventually they formed a volunteers group. Now, some places were real hotbeds of this, like Cork, and oftentimes you'd have 12 to 20 families. The clergy also had various degrees of involvement with this, sometimes even starting their own volunteer companies and really encouraging volunteering, even though the clergy could not take part directly because secret societies were against their oaths. Now, for a while, you also had a kind of pseudo-nationalism with the Redmondites. They became very popular, particularly at the start of World War I, when there was really a resurgence of British patriotism. But by 1915, they really petered out by that point because they really didn't have a purpose. They were only for maintaining the status quo. Now, for the Rising, you had some very unlikely leaders. You had this group of introverts, McDonough, Joseph Plunkett, Pearse. They had a real spiritual sense of Irish Revolution, but they weren't really so great militarily. They had this idea that they were going to cooperate with the Germans and they were going to get all this armament and troops, but that did not go as planned, as we've said before. There were some, such as Connolly, that were fairly leftist, and they thought that the poor would join in the revolution, but they really found that they did not. And this is a time when you see a lot of these rebels. They were Catholic, generally, to start out with, and they become all the more pious in the face of death. The Rising actually was secular, and you did have some Protestants in the Rising, but during the Rising, you really see this resurgence or this reliance upon Catholicism. There were also a lot of women that got involved. They got involved with a lot of traditional things like nurses, cooks, and messengers. The British, even though they knew about the Rising, they didn't really want to make too much of it. The Rising actually did take place, although it didn't take place quite when it had been expected. Pretty much occurred primarily in Dublin, even though it was supposed to be all over Ireland. Now, the Irish did what they could to fight honorably, but they had to resort to some tactics that were controversial, such as snipers, simply because they really didn't have enough numbers of the volunteers that actually showed up on that day. They didn't have enough ammunition, and they really had to make do with tools that were not very workable, such as antique Mausers, which they had to be reloaded after every shot. They would literally shoot fire, and they had to be cooled down after 3 shots. And they had all kinds of mismatched ammunition. I really don't know how they did anything with what little they had. But the Irish did make significant inroads in places such as Northumberland Road. They actually did a lot better than you would have expected. Now, there were other places in Ireland that saw action. For example, or that at least planned to see action, because you had the Galway volunteers that were prepared to divert the British troops from Dublin. And then you had the Dublin 5th Battalion, and I'm not actually sure where they were. They're called the Dublin 5th Battalion, and so perhaps they were in Dublin. But at any rate, they ended up ambushing a police convoy, and there was this battle in which only 2 volunteers were killed, and actually 7 of the police were killed and 16 were wounded, so the volunteers did very well. From that, for example, Thomas Ashe and Richard Mulcahy, they really saw a glimpse of what the IRA would be like and the kind of tactics they would use. But frankly, even though it was supposed to be a rising all over Ireland, there were a lot of leaders in Cork and Kilkenny and Limerick that really did not want to commit battalions to what was, by a lot of people, admitted to be really kind of a suicide mission. I mean, Pearse wanted to make the rising at Easter because he really saw it as a blood sacrifice for Ireland. And then what happened, of course, is eventually these Irish separatists that had barricaded themselves primarily in Dublin, although there was another place where they barricaded themselves called Athenry. But the thing is, barricading yourself anywhere is a mistake, and eventually they were overwhelmed by the British. They were taken to prison, and there a lot of them were executed, and they became martyrs, or else they went on hunger strikes. And they got a lot of sympathy from various Irish people, and eventually some of the Irish that were in the police started to rethink their position, either because they feared these volunteers and these IRB, or because they felt guilty about their lack of Irish patriotism. So, there was an interesting book. If you're interested in the rising, I think it's a worthwhile topic, and that's apparently Harold does too, and that's why he wanted me to review these books. And so I hope you enjoyed my review.
Paving stones were warm that day. The streets were strewn with gore, as window panes and rifles cracked amid that fiery roar. Oh God, make them stop soon, the young man thought in fear, as he lay upon the cold, hard floor, his blood a river that carried his life to the sea of death so near. He thought mournfully, there's no hope for us mere men trapped here alone, while lead from powerful cannons ripped through buildings made of stone. But they did. With Phoenix rising from the flames into the Easter skies, the words they hung on the now dead lips, arise, my land, arise.
Right, it's now Tuesday, October 22nd, and on this 10/22, it's appropriate that the BBBO, or Big Bolt Book Order, of the last Northwest Independence novel, Freedom's Sons, is finally starting to arrive from the publisher, having been shipped on a slow boat from China. Possibly literally so. This means that over the next week or so, signed copies of the book are going into the mail to just about any among you who had anything at all to do with the production or proofreading or financing of the book. And so if you have reason to believe you're on the list, you can hold off on buying one, which will save you some dough. I admit they're quite expensive. The hardback is almost $40 on Amazon, and the paperback is a little over $30. But what can I tell you? It's a big, huge, thick book of almost 1,000 pages, 979 to be exact if you include the glossary at the front. The quality of the production is, quite frankly, better than I thought it would be. The typeface doesn't look quite as small on the page in real life as I was afraid it was gonna. However, for those of you who don't want to spend $40 on a big, huge, thick book you have to lug around, and who don't mind reading on a screen, Freedom Sons is also available in Kindle from Amazon.com. Now, I have established a kind of semi-official Freedom Sons forum on the Homeland blog at www.northwestfront.org. That's the blog post for October the 10th. I'm moving comments sent to my own email and posted elsewhere to that site so that all of the collected comments I can find on the web will be there in one spot, and this can serve as the primary discussion forum for the novel on the web. Now, there aren't many comments on it yet because the novel has just come out, and it takes time to read a book of that length. But presumably, as copies start dropping in the mailboxes around the country and people read the whole book, and not just the excerpts of the Volume 1 from 2011, things will pick up. Now, guys, understand that this internet forum on that post is not just an exercise in narcissism on my part. I am not looking for endless pats on the back and endless repetitions of, "Gee, Harold, you sure act good." The fact is that the novel has been published mostly in bits and pieces and fragments over the past 3 years, a chapter at a time, intermittently on the Thought Crime blog, that kind of thing. And there are a lot of you who have never been able to sit down and read the whole thing from beginning to end, at least not in a comfortable format. What I would like from you is considered evaluations now that you are able to do so, and not little nitpicky stuff like, "Oh, there's a typo on page 357, although I'm sure despite all the proofreading, there are still some in there. Nor can I rewrite the book at this late stage, or change the plot, or change the characters, or anything like that. Now, what I need is your impression on how the book reads as a whole when you do sit down and read it from beginning to end. Does it hold together? Is it an effective, persuasive means of propaganda? And how effectively do you think I dealt with all the questions which you still had in your minds? Because these really are the last answers you're going to be getting, at least in fictional form. I really am all NVA'd out now, guys. So let me hear from you on the Homeland blog at northwestfront.org on the post for October the 10th. That's our official forum. A few of you have asked me where I got the title for the novel from. I got it from this song by Tommy Makem and the Clancy Brothers, which I first heard when I was about 15 years old. In view of the subject matter, I probably would have played this song as an accompaniment to Gretchen's book review just now, but this is also where the book title comes from.
This is the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rebellion in Dublin. And to commemorate that occasion, Tommy Makem wrote this song. It's called Freedom Sons.
In Dublin town they fought and died, with Pierce McDermott and McBride. Ourselves alone, their battle cry, and freedom sang to the Easter sky.
They were the men with the vision, the men with the cause, the men who defy their oppressors' laws, the men who traded their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons.
The poet's dream had sparked a flame, a raging fire it soon became, and from that fire of destiny there rose a nation proud and free.
The men with a cause, the men who defy their oppressors' laws, the men who trade
and their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons.
Well, I think at this point, politicians have made all the speeches that should be made. But I must say it was a great thrill, and I often thought of that line in the last few days. There rose a nation proud and free, especially when those jets were flying up over O'Connell Street. And I was saying to myself, them is our fellas that are flying.
Don't worry, comrades. One of these days, we too will be able to look up into the northwest sky and see a squadron of jet fighters and say, "Hot damn, those are our guys up there." All right, it's Wednesday morning now, and here's the situation. First off, my throat is not yet what it really should be in order for me to go off on a long, involved tirade. Secondly, I don't know how to put this, there has been a kind of convergence, harmonic or disharmonic, however you want to look at it, of things descending on me today. And again, this is kind of hard to describe if you don't understand exactly what it is I do with myself all day. And believe me, I have a lot to do every day. Anyway, things are descending on me all at once on this fine Wednesday of a nature such that only I can take care of them. Now, that's a large part of the problem I have here. It's one of the reasons I'm constantly begging and pleading for a national organizer, is because a large part of keeping this little kitchen table operation going, I am still doing myself. And there is a lot of stuff that, for various reasons, which I won't get into, only I can do. I do have some assistance here in the area. I have had for a while, but again, I'm not going to get into details, but a lot of this stuff requires, and I mean requires, my personal attention, and that's all happening today. The result is that I'm going to have to do something that I hate, hate, hate doing like the fires of hell. I am going to have to be very, very sloppy and offhand, and I'm going to have to basically slap something up on the show this week, because I simply don't have time to complete the show in a proper manner right now. I deeply and profoundly apologize for this. It is unprofessional, it's rude to you guys in the audience, and I despise having to do it, but sometimes there simply isn't any choice, and today is one of those days. Now, what I'm going to put up here for the rest of the show is an audio clip that one of our guys recorded off one of my earlier podcasts. I don't know which one. It's on one of his favorite subjects, character and the goat dance and so forth and so on. So all you gossip lovers out there will no doubt enjoy this. I am going to put a portion of this 23-minute segment up. I'm not going to use all of it. I'll give you another music break, and then I'll go ahead and wind up the show with what amounts to a canned segment or a rerun or however you want to call it. Again, I understand this is sloppy. It is rude. I don't like doing it, but just today, I just have no choice. When someone becomes involved with the white resistance movement in any way whatsoever, with any group or any of our many tendencies, National Socialist, Christian Identity, skinhead, militia, whatever, very early on, they run into what I call Covington's conundrum. The cause is so right, the people in it are so wrong. One of the first things one learns is that the movement is full of people who do not belong here, because of flaws in their minds or flaws in their character. People who have no business anywhere near us or any other form of alternative politics. Now, the type of people we do need, on the other hand, seem to stay away in droves. Why is this? Why do we do it? I think that's the first question we all ask ourselves. Why do we act like we do? Why are we like this? Why, judging from our internet posts, are so many of us clearly unsuitable for any serious role in the white resistance movement, unsuitable indeed for a serious role in anything to do with real life? White nationalists, by and large, give a whole new dimension of meaning to the word dysfunctional. Why the blind and unreasoning hatred directed against individuals within our own ranks, far worse and far more extensive than any hatred or anger they seem to feel toward the racial enemy? I can't count how many times down through the years I've heard some variation on the phrase of, if only so-and-so spent half as much time attacking the Jews, the niggers, or the government as he spends attacking his personal enemies X, Y, and Z, he'd really be something. I'm not just talking about all the silly horseshit that's directed against me personally, not by a long shot. This phenomenon of movement bullshit transcends any one person. It's not about the people who are being targeted by it. It's about the people who are producing and posting it, about what's going on in the minds of the goat dancers themselves. Now, some of you who picked up on last week's podcast and checked around the internet probably caught some of the frenzied hatred directed against Bill White, which is as bad as anything ever aimed at me. So this clearly isn't just an anti-Covington or anti-Northwest phenomenon. The space madness is not about me or about the Northwest. It's about us and who we are. Goat dancers say much more about themselves in their deranged internet posts than they ever say about me. But once again, the question rises up and will not be denied. Why are we like this? In the face of the 1001 things that we all should be doing that are so clearly much more important, why are we acting like this? Now, some people believe that anyone who behaves in a manner that's so clearly counterproductive and which so clearly makes us look like fools and brings the cause into disrepute must be paid enemy agents. And as I've pointed out, sometimes this is probably true. The Cognitive Dissonance Project of White House Deputy Communications Director Cass Sunstein most definitely does exist. I'm not making it up. But Cass Sunstein doesn't explain the last 6 or 7 decades. The final answer is, I don't know. I admit it. I've been studying this problem for almost 40 years myself, and I've developed a few tentative theories, but I admit it. I'm no closer to solving this vitally important riddle than I was in 1972 when I first came in. The internet hasn't helped, to be sure. It has certainly exacerbated and accelerated the space madness like the very devil, kind of like injecting nitro into a car's fuel line. But I can tell you, even in the days before the internet, we were always like this. In the old days, we attacked one another in our garage mimeographed newsletters. We mailed out quote-unquote open letters by the score. We did our slandering and conducted our whispering campaigns by telephone and on our recorded phone messages. These days we do it by Facebook and Twitter, but it's the same old lunatic song. We have to stop this. The future existence of our race depends on what will happen in the next few years, on whether or not the Northwest Front, this movement, no one else, can do what nobody else has been able to do and successfully break out of the bubble. Begin to reach out of our silly and tiny little movement and into the actual white community of what I may loosely refer to as normal people, because the Northwest is the only thing going right now that counts. There isn't anything else that has even a remote chance of success, and there's not going to be anything else. Now, this means that we have to find some way to solve this problem and isolate and neutralize the people among us who refuse to stop acting like horses' asses. I understand how desperately, desperately we do not want to hear this, but we have to talk about it. We have to take our fingers out of our ears and not only hear it, but understand it and act to end it. Now, to be sure, things are a little bit better than they used to be a few years ago. One thing about the internet is that the character problem in the movement has become so obvious that it can't be swept under the rug anymore, and it's become impossible to enforce the old taboo. The internet releases our inner nut in a way that makes it impossible to pretend that the problem doesn't exist. Back when we had only printed publications and newsletters circulating through people's mailboxes, the old fearless leaders could successfully isolate and write off most criticism by saying that they were being quote-unquote attacked and by wrapping themselves in the flag of so-called white unity, which is something that has never in fact existed, and something which, in view of the kind of people we have in the movement, probably should not exist. There are people claiming to be white nationalists whom we don't need to be unified with, so-called comrades that we need to keep as far the hell away from as possible. Anyway, the new rules seem to be that I can pretty much discuss the problem so long as I don't actually name names. I don't fully understand that rule. I think it's because if I name names, it would embarrass people among us who were taken in by these flawed groups and individuals and who don't want to admit that they were suckered. That may have something to do with it, but whatever. Now, earlier on I mentioned Covington's conundrum. The cause is so right, the people in it are so wrong. But there's also Covington's corollary. Just because the people are so wrong, that doesn't mean the cause is not right. I just said I understand that I am apparently prohibited by some unwritten law from naming names or talking about specific episodes, but I'm going to partially violate that prohibition now. I'm going to talk about one of the most shameful and disgraceful incidents that ever occurred in our wee little movement, and how I dealt with it. I will not name names, but this story is so infamous, and it excited so much disgust at the time, even among us, that a lot of you will remember what happened, or you'll have heard the story, and you'll know who I'm referring to, which bothers me not at all. Okay, this is me back on October the 23rd, 2013 again, and after some thought, no, I think we're going to leave that one buried. We really don't need to be digging that particular piece of goo-boo lunacy up again. Sorry to disappoint all you Americans out there with your incredible lust for gossip. Anyway, back to the old audio clip. And then I sat down, and I poured myself a cup of coffee, and I did something that I'd done before, and have done a couple of times since then, but never quite as seriously and deeply as this time. I had a long re-examination and rethink over my entire life with a view toward trying to determine if maybe, just maybe, I was on the wrong track. Now, bear in mind that at that time, I was only 43 years of age. That's hitting middle age, but one of the things that America used to offer, which no other country in the world offered, was endless fresh starts. It's not like that now, but in 1996, and at age 43, it still wasn't too late for me to try and start over. I could find myself a job somewhere there in the Research Triangle, find some good old country gal with maybe a couple of young but decent kids from a previous marriage who was willing to marry me in order to get a second income and a semi-decent father for her kids. I could set up house somewhere out in the county, maybe in a double-wide mobile home down along Orange Grove Road where my own wealthy family lives, just to embarrass the hell out of them, whatever. Or I could just say fuck it all and light out for wherever I wanted to try and start over. West Coast, New Mexico, Louisiana bayous, back to Ireland, wherever. It was still possible. I was still young enough. There was still time. But first, I knew that I had to convince myself that it was never going to get off the ground because we ourselves were never going to change, and that the whole thing was really, honest to God, hopeless. Now, if this really was the best that the movement could come up with after 50 years of effort, then I had my answer.
Remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha! You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed. You laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed. I heard you laugh. You laughed and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. I cooked your food, I cleaned your house, and this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Ha! Well, you just wait, they'll find you yet, and when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt! And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, to the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away.
And so I sat down, and I had my long rethink, remembering everything that I'd been through since 1972, weighing all the 101 incidents like this that I had witnessed or gone through since then, sign after sign, hell, neon sign after neon sign, that we are completely morally unworthy as a race to live, and that we are never going to change. I have to admit, those signs are still there in large measure. You can see them every day on the Internet. Outside the Northwest Front, there hasn't really been any change or improvement for the past 15 years. Instead, almost all physical activity of any kind has disappeared, and we've been totally absorbed into the Internet like that movie The Matrix, so to speak, except we don't have all the superpowers. Back in 96, every ounce of logic dictated that I should proceed to shut my existing operation down with a last mail-out bulletin, change addresses to some place that the shitheads hopefully couldn't find me, and try and rebuild some kind of life for myself while I still had the chance. I didn't, as we all know. Instead, I ended up in Texas and then came to the Northwest. I ended up writing 4 Northwest Independence novels, and I'm working on the 5th. Our little Northwest Republic exists at least in the world of the mind, complete with a flag and a constitution, and the same insane goat dance has gone on for the past 15 years and continues to this day. So why? Why didn't I make the decision back then to get the hell out while I had the chance and never look back? A couple of reasons. I've mentioned them before, but I'm going to mention them again now, because you're going to have to weigh these reasons when the time comes for you to go through your own dark night of the soul, as you almost certainly will, more than once as the years progress. The first thing you have to do in order to make what I believe is the right decision is to understand that Covington's conundrum is just that. It's a conundrum. The cause is so right, the people in it are so wrong. It's simply a fact of life, something that just is, and it can't be analyzed or explained any more than any other mystery of the cosmos. This is a truth you have to accept, because you can't really function if you don't. But just because you accept a truth doesn't mean you necessarily need to understand it. This is one of those questions like, why is there death and suffering in the world? And why does God let bad things happen to good people while bad people always seem to win all the time? I always laugh my head off at the Christian Church's wide variety of incredibly lame answers to those questions to try and explain away one of the greatest contradictions in their religion. There is no answer, of course, at least none that makes any sense. Being a white nationalist and a political soldier of our race is kind of like trying to be a Christian. You have to work out some kind of mental defense mechanism against the unpalatable fact that there seems to be something fundamentally wrong, and there just plain isn't any answer that makes sense. Some people will go with the free will thing. Some people just go with the Lord works in mysterious ways thing, whatever. But you have to learn to take in stride the fact that most people who become involved in this thing of ours for whatever mystical, inexplicable reasons simply are not who and what they should be. You accept it as a fact of life, just one of those things that will no doubt be explained in the fullness of cosmic time on the judgment day or whatever, and you drive on. The late Pastor Bob Miles had a theory about this, which is a pretty good one, I think, if you believe in God and divine intervention. He called it the cosmic thumb theory. Bob believed that there is, in fact, a god or gods or a great pumpkin or whatever guiding human destiny, and he believed that this divine force had its thumb on the scale, quietly keeping us down, disorganized, disunified, and suppressed, so that we don't get our act together too soon and attack Zog while Zog is still too strong, charging headlong into the machine guns and into the mincing machine of the system and destroying our race's last chance because we simply did not have the patience and the discipline to wait until the time is right. Well, I hope Bob was correct, but even if he's not, I simply had to go with Covington's corollary. Just because the people are so wrong, that doesn't mean the cause is not right. I think that's the key. We have to depersonalize all this and recognize that what we're doing has, in fact, very little to do with the world that exists around us, as dangerous and as revolting as that world is. Our dedication to the 14 words has virtually nothing to do with anybody except ourselves, the dead souls of our people who have come and gone in the world, the unborn souls of those yet to come, and our own role as the connection between them. This has nothing to do with some imbecile making nasty comments about me or anybody else on the Internet. This behavior is a mere symptom of our racial disease, and it's so low and peripheral that it doesn't even register on the scale of significance. Anyone who does these things automatically takes themselves out of the game because they've made themselves irrelevant. They're just background noise, static. We are all responsible for our own moral fiber and our own spiritual transformation and our own role in a world historical struggle and no one else's. In other words, if you're going to quit the movement and go off and try and hide in a cabin in the woods, or in my case, a double wide on Orange Grove Road, then it needs to be because you yourself have failed. You yourself have given up because you can't cut it. Not because some other person or group of people has so disgusted you that you leave because you simply don't want to deal with childishness and viciousness anymore. It's like leaving the room when somebody cuts a fart. If there's nothing going on in the room that you need to be involved in, that's one thing. But in this case, we need to stay in the room and put up with the smell. More simply, if anybody ever runs me out of this life, it'll be someone or something a hell of a lot more serious and powerful than a bad doggy who shits on my doorstep. I owe that much to myself. And you need to take the same attitude. I know that when you see some of the nonsense that goes on, you may ask yourself, do I really want to stay in this mess? Is it worth it? Well, that's not the way to phrase the question. You should be saying, am I going to be forced out of a way of life that I know in my heart to be right because of simple irritation at the behavior of some overgrown child? Is it worth it to live with that kind of guilt for the rest of my life? Now, we claim devotion to the cause, but we refuse actually to do anything for it that involves risk and inconvenience, and that sometimes includes our refusal to put up with simple annoyances. We have to be stronger than that. If you can't put up with some jerk-off saying nasty things about you on a blog, then you don't have what it takes to overthrow the most powerful tyranny in the history of mankind. If the Northwest Movement doesn't get its act together, 100 years from now there will be no more Caucasian people in North America and probably only a few million left in the world hiding in some valley in Eastern Europe or some godforsaken village out on the Canadian tundra. That's a hell of a price to pay for allowing ourselves to be hijacked and distracted from our duty by silly little morons. So what do? We keep on sifting the stream of toxic waste, looking for those few flecks of gold at the bottom of the pan. We are going to have to learn to trust one another in the face of massive evidence from our past behavior that we shouldn't. I wish I could offer some magical formula as to how this can be achieved. I can't. I'm just telling you that it has to be done. We hope for the man on the white horse who will draw his saber and wave it aloft, and then all our problems will vanish. He will not come. There is no man on a white horse, and there's nothing left for the white race anywhere within democracy or any other movement outside Northwest migration, and white nationalism as a whole, insofar as it may lead to Northwest migration. We have to transform ourselves into the kind of men and women our ancestors were. Now you keep asking, but Harold, what are you talking about? We don't understand. Well, in my Northwest novels, I attempted to show you the kind of people I'm talking about, but you don't have to rely on my books. All that's necessary is for all of us to look back into our past, and we can see the kind of men and women that we need to be. You know, those people who preceded us by hundreds and thousands of years didn't do so in a vacuum. They left behind records. They left behind the stories of their deeds. They left behind their works of art. They left behind their words. We can hear them if we know how to listen. Well, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban, freedom.
The men who defied their oppressors' laws, the men who traded their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons.
At Easter time, 1916,
when flowers bloom and leaves were green. There dawned the day when freedom's cry called on brave men, come fight or die. They were the men with the vision, the men with the cause, the men who defied their oppressors' laws, the men who traded their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons. In Dublin town, they fought and died. With Pierce, MacDermot, and McBride. Ourselves alone, their battle cry. And freedom rang to that Easter sky. They were the men with the vision, the men with the cause, the men who defied their oppressors' laws, the men who traded their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons. A poet's dream had sparked a flame, a raging fire it soon became, and from that fire of destiny arose a nation proud and free. They were the men with the vision, the men with the cause, the men who defied their oppressors' laws, the men who traded their chains for guns. Born into slavery, they were freedom's sons.